business of sport on Share Radio.
Hello and welcome to the business of sport. My name is Michael Considine. Thank you for joining us today. Plenty to come in this week's show. In a moment, I'll be speaking to football finance expert Simon Chadwick from Salford University in Manchester on the influence China is starting to exert not just on the footballing world, but on the wider sporting world as well. And in the second part of the show, I'll be taking a look at the new logo from Juventus with brand expert John Rosenblatt from Brantix. And of course, Alex Clark will have extra time.
The business of sport on Share Radio.
Another transfer window means many things. The prospect of a new signing turning a club season around, the loss of your best player to the elite clubs, while more recently it also means fevered speculation linking some of the world's top players to the Chinese Super League. There is some respite on the horizon, however, for clubs with new rules from the Chinese FA limiting the number of overseas players to 3 for the new season. For more on this and a host more, I'm delighted to say that I've been joined by Professor Simon Chadwick, Professor of Sports Enterprise at Salford University in Manchester. Simon, thank you for joining us today. Let's start with the Chinese Super League and those overseas transfers and the limits now being imposed on clubs. Do you think that's going to make much of a difference?
I think it is to a certain extent in the way that we're not going to see large numbers of overseas players going to China. So it's not going to be like the Premier League where a starting 11 can consist entirely of foreigners. The Chinese Super League is different, and we're going to have teams dominated by Chinese players. And this is significant for China because obviously what they're seeking to do is not to buy the rest of the world's talent, but to actually develop its own. So I think that's the first thing to say. But you've got to keep in mind that still Chinese teams can play three foreign players on the pitch at the start of a game. And so there are still three opportunities to make three big name signings from the rest of the world. And so I think we will still see big stars heading China's way. I think those big salaries and those big transfer fees will continue too. And so there will be still a lot of hype and a lot of speculation about who might move to China next. I think the other thing to stress is that we tend to talk about the Chinese Super League, and there are 18 clubs in the Chinese Super League, but there is a Chinese football pyramid below that. And already we've seen the likes of Clarence Seedorf managing in the second division in China, and there are several other players and managers from Europe already in the second division. So it's not just about signing players for the Super League, it's also about signing players who will play in teams further down the league structure as well.
And you also make a very good point there regarding Clarence Seedorf. I suppose there's no limits really on the off-field talent that we could see being poached from Europe and from across the world and parachuted into the Chinese pyramid structure, like you said.
I mean, that's a great point. Currently, there, as far as I'm aware, there aren't any regulations on that. So it's not inconceivable that the next great frontier could be European and South American coaches going to South America. And clearly, we've already seen the likes of Seedorf. We've got Fabio Cannavaro, the former Juve and Italy captain, who's coaching in China. I think the other thing as well is that As you go down through club structures, it's not just the head coaches or the directors of football or the managers who potentially could be non-Chinese. You've got whole coaching structures that are populated by not just Europeans, but others too. So, for example, in Shanghai, there's a guy called Mads Davidsson, who's a Dane, who's become quite well known and influential in terms of Chinese football development. So you're right, there are others in the Chinese football system who are not Chinese, and currently there's no particular regulation on that.
And I doubt we should see much coming from it either, considering the goal being a World Cup coming to China, not just the tournament itself, but also the trophy itself, populated by Chinese players. And of course, the talent for that needs to be developed. And I suppose one could argue that there isn't the intellectual rigour in the Chinese coaches at this stage, more so there is within the European coaches.
Well, it's not just coaches, it's players too. So I think one of the things that your listeners need to appreciate is this is not all about big money and big names and lots of hype. China is very, very keen to learn more about football. And so that embraces everything from learning how to coach, learning how to manage, but also learning how to run a club, learning how to attract sponsorships, how to build a fan base, but also on the field, learning how to construct teams and learning new skills, learning tactics, learning new ways of playing. And yes, clearly there's a lot of what we might call hot money in China right now, and there is a lot of hype around football, and excessive wages and salaries are being paid. But I think one of the unseen and equally significant components of all of this is the desire of the Chinese to learn, because clearly, if they are going to become a leading FIFA nation by 2050, which is what their goal is, and ultimately to win the trophy, they need to learn how to play like Germany or Spain or Brazil, and they need to know how to develop players who will populate those kind of teams. So China and learning is a really important aspect of all of this.
Now, you mentioned hot money there just now, and that's not just limited to football either, really, is it? When we look at news out this week, which says that the International Olympic Committee has a new deal with Chinese firm Alibaba. They're going to be the top sponsor from now on. And this is just a further sign of how Chinese money and Chinese organisations are populating not just the on-field aspect of things, but also the supply chain toward all of that as well.
Essentially, the focus on football specifically came out of an announcement at the end of 2014 from the Chinese president, which said that he wants China to create the world's biggest domestic sport economy by 2025. So currently this is the United States, but China wants to be number one by 2025. So this is not just about playing football and winning some tournaments. It is actually about building an industry that employs people, that generates economic activity, that generates overseas earnings, that contributes to gross domestic product, the gross domestic product of China, and ultimately becomes a market and an industrial leader. So within that, yes, we can talk about football players and signings, but there are also lots of other things happening too. Alibaba and its sponsorship of the Olympics is one thing. Just to give you another example, we have Wanda, which is one of China's biggest corporations, and its sponsorship of the FIFA World Cup. But then we've got all kinds of things. Just to give you one example, World Iron Man is now Chinese owned. So this is a part of a concerted and strategic attempt by China and its business people and other investors to put China in a position where by 2025 it will be one of the biggest, if not the biggest, domestic sport economy in the world.
Yes, and that is quite an interesting thought as well. And it's been very interesting to see President Xi Jinping in Davos this week, not just mixing with the world's political elite, but also the world's sporting elite as well.
The Chinese are very, very good at some people might call it soft power, but in other ways, it's even more subtle than that. It might be called subtle power. They tend to be not openly or publicly or aggressively coercive in the sense that, they tend to do things by forging relationships with people, establishing a kind of bond where there's mutual trust, and then they use that as the basis for gaining access to sponsorship opportunities, tournament bidding decisions, kind of relationships with sports governing bodies. And I think it's entirely in keeping with the Chinese way of doing business that this week Xi, when he visited Davos for the World Economic Forum, at the same time couldn't help but drop in at the IOC to meet the president of the IOC. Now that's the way that China does business.
Very interesting idea. I like the way you phrased that. You mentioned earlier that the US is a leader in sports economy, and Chinese ambitions are to capitalize upon that and overtake that by 2025. Do you think, and moving away from sport economy just for a moment, but it also links in nicely, do you think that there, with President-elect Trump, now soon to be President Trump, and his rhetoric towards China so far and the potential of a trade war between the two countries, do you think that will have any effects on the global sports landscape?
Absolutely, completely, 100%. I think the 20th century was really dominated by the United States. When I say the 20th century, the sporting 20th century was dominated by the United States. So really, sponsorships were developed by the United States. The whole notion of TV rights and commercial rights came out of the United States. And so, even for those of us who like the Premier League, the way in which the Premier League functions today is a reflection of the 20th century model of sport, which came out of the United States. What will happen in the 21st century, and we're already beginning to see this, and obviously we're aware of China buying football clubs, China hosting the Olympic Games in 2022, it wants to host the World Cup. What we're now going to see in the 21st century is China fighting back and trying to impose a Chinese model of sport in the same way as we saw a US model of sport in the 20th century. Now, I think there's something absolutely crucial here, and that is, how does Donald Trump see this, and what will his response to it actually be? And so just as potentially we're on the cusp of a diplomatic standoff between the countries, just as potentially we may well be heading towards a trade standoff between the two countries, I think we might also be heading towards a sports standoff. And so I think what happens over the next year, as Trump gets into office and begins to formulate policy, will have profound consequences, I think, for how sport looks in 5 years, in 10 years, and then ultimately in 2099, what it looks like then.
Do you think the American sports industry has deep enough pockets to challenge the Chinese sports industry and this attempt to overthrow them?
One of the characteristics of North American sport has been this almost like this tremendous process of renewal. So they are hugely competent in sport, very creative, very innovative, commercially focused in a way that many countries still aren't. And so I think the United States has a capacity to respond to competitive threats from elsewhere in the world. But clearly here is an economy that 20 years ago was nowhere, and now very, very quickly has ascended to second position in the world in terms of largest economy. It's set to overtake the American economy sometime over the next 5 to 10 years. It is not inconceivable that by the time we get to, let's say, 2030, when it's forecast that China will host the Football World Cup, that China could well be in a position by then that it is the dominant global force in sport, both in terms of on-field activity, but I think also in terms of off-field activity, business, commercial investments, these kinds of things.
Fascinating. Well, thank you very much for joining us here in the Business of Sport. That's Professor Simon Chadwick, Professor of Sports Enterprise at Salford University in Manchester. Simon, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
After the break, I'll be speaking to brand expert John Rosenblatt on Juventus's new logo.
The Business of Sport on Share Radio.
Welcome back to the Business of Sport. My name is Michael Considine. Italian football club Juventus this week launched a new logo for the club, with club president Andrea Agnelli announcing that, and I quote, "This new logo is a symbol of the Juventus way of living." The launch of the new club crest, however, has seen backlash among supporters, with one fan on Twitter saying, "The new logo tells me that this is a Juventus brand and we are customers, not fans." For more on this, I'm joined by John Rosenblatt, CEO of Brandtix. John, thank you for joining us today. What was your reaction to this?
I think I can understand the backlash from a lot of the fans in Italy. I think it's a big departure from what they've been used to over the last 100 years. I certainly can understand why that's the case. But actually, on further evidence, it's interesting to look on our platform that really only in the last week, about 30% of total Juventus conversation actually does take place in Italy, with Brazil, UK, USA and France also making up some decent numbers. So you can understand the most emotional fans being critical of that, but I think there are other football fans that love Juventus or support Juventus that might not quite be so critical of the new design.
Who are they trying to attract with this new logo?
My sense is that the club is looking to expand their brand into new emerging international territories, North America, Brazil in many respects, I think, and obviously the Far East. That's my sense, and I think that they're moving into modern times. And if you look at tech companies and the way that they're trying to kind of create an ident and a logo that's immediately synonymous with that brand, I think that Juventus are probably trying to do something similar. Again, if you look at the Serie A logos across all the teams, that they're all relatively similar. So when you've got these new kids from China or North America who are wanting to support a team or wanting to support a load of players that play for Juventus, it's far more recognisable now than it may have been, you know, over the last 100 years.
But many supporters would argue that their club crest was already quite distinctive.
Well, they're the supporters of today. I sense that, you know, Juventus are probably looking at opportunities to expand that fan base. You know, they're quite a far way, but certainly in Italy, they're extremely, from a social media perspective, a very, very important club. But on a global scale, if you look at just pure kind of social media numbers against your Spanish giants and your Premier League giants, Juventus kind of, I think, 10th in the most followed club around the world. So the opportunity for them to grow their fan base and to understand who those fans are in those new emerging markets and monetize them might be part and parcel of the way in which they're thinking about this modernization of the logo.
Now, your company is all about understanding brand value and quantifying it as well. Does this change actually add more value to the brand?
Well, we saw yesterday just the most enormous volume spike, which was one of the reasons why their brand value as of yesterday went up. And actually, interestingly, from our sentiment analysis, it was pretty much at 50-50. So whilst there was a huge amount of news articles saying that Twitter, fans around Juventus are slamming the new logo, from our technology and from our research, we're looking at around a 50-50 split. And like I say, that's probably off the back of the fact that 30% of all the engagement across social is coming from Italy, whereas 60-odd% is coming from 70% is coming from elsewhere. So, and again, I think it's easier to find the faults when people are vociferous in their criticism than it necessarily is to look at the positives. And Paris have gone through redesigns, West Ham have gone through redesigns, Liverpool have gone through redesigns. They've never necessarily lost the identity, which I think is probably the biggest departure. So the Hammers for West Ham and the Live Bird for Liverpool, the Eiffel Tower for Paris still remains central to the theme of the club. So the loss of the crown, the loss of the bull, the loss of that Juventus look and feel since 1905 definitely is something that the fans in Turin are obviously extremely upset about.
Now, how can we actually track the brand value of clubs?
Well, we track the brand value of clubs at Brandtix by looking at a number of different criteria. First of all, we don't believe that you can be a successful brand unless you're successful on the pitch. So if we're talking about football, we are looking at Juventus's on-pitch statistics. So how often they're winning, both in the Serie A together with their Champions League, how many goals they're scoring, how many goals they're conceding, and so on and so forth. But at the same time, the brand value of Juventus is also based on the off-pitch. So we look at their social media, the acquisition of their followers. So how many new followers are they gaining by week, by month, by season? And we can compare that against their competitors in Italy and around the world. We also look at their engagement. So how engaged are their fans on their followers around the world when they're posting stuff across social media? And then we also look at the sentiment analysis. So the better the clubs are doing on pitch, the more fans they're getting, obviously the higher the brand value of that club's going to be, because the success factors are determined by those key features. And then we create this index that allows the Nikes, the Adidases, and lots of sponsorship agencies to understand the true brand value of Juventus versus Milan, Man United, or Liverpool, or anyone else in Champions League and Premier League.
You mentioned there the on-pitch success and analysing that, and how that impacts then on the number of new fans that they attract in as well. And that really does pinpoint a key specific factor in sports and in sports fandom in the last number of years, in that before, if you had a club, you had a club for life. Whereas now, and I've mentioned this before in other interviews, people have one club, two clubs, maybe even four clubs that they follow as well. And so it's pinpointing, I suppose, the way that football fandom is moving forward.
Oh, absolutely, Michael. I think one of the most interesting things when I headed up EA Sports Marketing for many years, and one of the really interesting things when we were doing all of our FIFA research was looking at these emerging markets, big markets like the States, where actually they tend to follow the player before they follow the club. So they actually are fans of Messi, not fans of Barcelona. So if Messi was to move to Manchester City, for example, they would go and then support Messi at Manchester City. So there's the, when I was growing up, my dad, my granddad, my uncle, we were all Liverpool fans growing up in Liverpool. That's, and I'm trying to obviously indoctrinate that through to my children, but they're not, it's a different way of thinking now. And the quicker that clubs realize that they are global brands and have the ability to go and be successful in other countries outside of where they play, is I think one of the biggest challenges, but also one of the biggest opportunities. I think 99% of sports fans or football fans never watch a match live. But we see on our Brandtix platform every day the likes of Barcelona, Real Madrid, Manchester United are continuing to just absolutely dominate the off-pitch success rates. It's quite staggering. We did a piece of research just earlier this week where if we look at the 20 million social followers that have come in to follow a football club in the Premier League since the start of the season, United have acquired 30% of them, which is staggering considering, you'd think that they've actually had a couple of years of being in the wilderness compared to the likes of City and Chelsea and Arsenal.
20 million new followers since the start of the season?
No, so 20 new followers since the start of the season have followed a Premier League team, of which United have commanded 30% of that share.
That's a staggering number, particularly that we're into, January, it's 5 months? That's a staggering number of new followers and new fans for the Premier League to accrue over that period of time, isn't it? I mean, how does have we got any other kind of reasonable sense of thing to compare it against?
I don't think else you can compare it against, because, you know, as big as NFL is, it will only ever really be a truly American sport. And I think it's the same with baseball. Basketball, I think, continues to grow in China, but struggles elsewhere in Europe. There is, you know, rugby is an emerging sport, which I think is very exciting, but nothing will ever get to the kind of levels that you're seeing here. I mean, you know, Man United, since the start of the season, have acquired 6 million new social followers. And, you know, Ibrahimovic as a footballer actually has more social followers than Liverpool and Everton combined. So the power of the player, the power of the athlete, and the power of some of these brands now reaching millions of fans all over the world is, you know, it's a game changer in the world of football. I just think that the football clubs have the opportunity now to really modernize their way of thinking, which I think Juventus have done quite substantially and radically over the last 24 hours. But that will die down, and Juventus fans will still be Juventus fans. And when Juventus win the league, when they get to the Champions League final or semi-final and sign amazing players, they will still wear those shirts. They will still adorn the badge. We're all football fans, and we all want success.
I must say, as a United fan, it does tickle me that Ibrahimovic has more followers than Everton and Liverpool combined. But back to Juventus. And do we expect more clubs to do this moving forward into the future?
I do, yeah. I think what they've done is a huge departure. There's no doubt about it. As a football fan, I think it's a huge departure. But I really believe that modernizing the brands, making the crests and the logos immediately identifiable across the world, is going to be something that's that every agency is going to be. You know, I think Interbrand did this work for Juventus, but all of these kind of branding agencies are going to be working with. I would be surprised to see such a massive departure from. I wouldn't have thought a Real Madrid or a Barcelona would go down that road of completely removing some of the key symbols of their logo. But I absolutely believe that this is the way it's going to move forward, yeah.
Very interesting indeed. Well, thank you very much for joining us here in the Business of Sport. That's John Rosenblatt, CEO of Brandix. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Time now for a roundup of the week's sports business news.
We're headed for extra time.
Welcome to Extra Time. I'm Alex Clark. Boris Johnson will be asked to justify his management of London's Olympic Stadium as part of an investigation into skyrocketing conversion costs. The bill for turning the ground into West Ham's new home has risen by £50 million. The former London mayor is among a number of officials who will be asked to explain their conduct to an inquiry set up by his successor, Sadiq Khan. For the first time in over a decade, Manchester United are the richest club in football. They've overtaken Real Madrid at the top of Deloitte's Football Money League. United became the first club to earn more than £500 million in a season during the 2015-2016 campaign. Premier League champions Leicester are in the top 20 for the first time. F1's governing body, the FIA, has approved the sale of its commercial rights to Liberty Media. Investment group CVC Capital Partners is currently the sport's majority shareholder. But the US-based Liberty is in the process of buying a controlling stake in F1. That's expected to go through in the next 4 weeks. Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba Group has been announced as the newest member of the International Olympic Committee, or IOC's, top-tier sponsorship roster. Joining the Olympic Partner Program, the conglomerate becomes both the official cloud services and official e-commerce platform services partner of the IOC. Alibaba has also been named as a founding partner of the Olympic Channel, the new over-the-top broadcasting platform of the Olympic movement. Canon, the world's leading manufacturer of cameras and imaging equipment, has been named as the first official sponsor of the 2019 Rugby World Cup in Japan. The company, which is headquartered in the Japanese capital of Tokyo, will provide support to members of the press throughout the six-week-long tournament. 2019 will mark the second consecutive Rugby World Cup for which Canon has been an official partner, after it also sponsored the 2015 edition in England. And finally, American football team Oakland Raiders have applied for relocation to Las Vegas in 2020. The move to the USA's gambling capital would need to be approved by three-quarters of NFL clubs. The Raiders plan to play at a new 65,000-capacity stadium. They'd be the second major sports team in Las Vegas, after recently established Vegas Golden Knights, who will play in ice hockey's NHL from next season. That's all from Extra Time. Back to Michael.
Alex Clark with Extra Time, and that's all we have for this week's show. Don't forget you can catch up on this show and the rest of our previous shows on the Share Radio website. That's www.shareradio.co.uk. My thanks for joining us today, and my thanks to all of our guests as well. My name is Michael Considine. I'll see you next week.
The Business of Sport on Share Radio.